Okay, I think we're good. Okay, take it away.
Great. Well, glad you guys could be here. Thanks for having me. So just a little bit of background, a little context, and I know Vincent's already laid some of that out. So I've been at Baylor, 25 years, coming up in April. It's hard to believe. We were at the young adult service last night, and one of the questions was, you know, how long have you been at Waco? And we're sitting there, we're telling the story of how when we moved to Waco and I came to Baylor, we had some friends back in Knoxville that said, hey, that had gone to Baylor, said, hey, you know, go to Highland. So our first Sunday here was at Highland, and that happened to also be the Sunday that Jimmy stood up and announced that they were doing Antioch. And so that was sometime in April, and we jumped in from day one. So, and I know there's a lot of folks that have that Highland connection, but we've been here since day one. So my role at Baylor, I'm a psychologist by training, and so I serve as the dean for all the student health and wellness services. I'm also the executive director of the counseling center. So anything related to health and wellness at the university, that's what I do. So, but today we're going to talk specifically about mental health and specifically about suicide. And this is a program called QPR. It stands for Question, Persuade, and Refer. And it's really three skills that anyone can do to intervene in the life of someone who might be thinking about suicide. Just a couple of things, a few goals I have for today, certainly raise awareness about suicide, some of the facts about suicide, clues, warning signs. There's a lot of myths about suicide, so I hope to address some of those as well, and then talk about some of these three skills that you can use. I will say one thing, you know, mental health in general is a big, really big topic in our society. My world tends to be Baylor. Mental health, wellness in general is it's high on the list. If you were to go to any, you know, collegiate conference in the country, it's top three on the list of what we're doing for, particularly for young adults. But I think that really of our society as a whole. COVID was an accelerator, so there was a lot of trends that we were seeing in the area of mental health, but when COVID hit, it just accelerated everything. And I think you see that in some of the data, but I'll give you another one in terms of mental health. One of those is eating disorders, right? I mean, at our campus, you know, it's just been a steady line for 20-something years, right? And then COVID hits, and it greatly accelerated. Things that were mild became moderate became severe. Just really had that kind of effect, and I think it's had it in some different ways. I do want to share just a few thoughts about suicide, you know, in the U.S. And I was telling Vincent earlier, just to kind of get updated, I went to the CDC website, and I know it's. And let me cut back up a little bit. One thing I would say about this topic, this is a heavy topic, all right? And we are talking about suicide. It's a serious topic. It's a heavy topic. I recognize that even in a room that's maybe got about 10 people in it, I would imagine there are people in this room that certainly know someone who's thought about suicide, attempted suicide, committed suicide. All of us in our humanity, if we've been through times of depression, it's probably crossed our mind as well, right? So, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. So, anyway, I recognize that, and also I'd say if, you know, after this, if we needed to follow up in some way, I'd be glad to do that. But a few things about suicide in the U.S. is that they estimate that just in the time that we're here this morning, about 7 people will commit suicide in the U.S. The most recent statistics they have in 2021 said there were a little over 48,000 documented suicides in the U.S. So quick question, any thoughts on why they're very specific to use that word documented? About 48,000 documented suicides in the U.S. Any thoughts on why they're intentional about that phrase? Yeah.
Overdose on medication.
Right. Yeah, there might be some examples of where we don't know what their intent was. You know, an overdose on medication might be one of those examples, and there's a few others. So the number's probably a little higher, than that because of what we may know or may not know. They also estimate that the number of that for every completed act of suicide, there's probably 25 attempts. So the number of attempts greatly outnumbers the number of completed acts of suicide. So a few things, you know, that I picked up just looking at the CDC website. There's a cool graphic there that you can look at causes of death going back to the early 1980s. And really about 2013, suicide becomes the second leading cause of death, and it stayed that way for the last 11 years. The number one cause of death is what they call unintentional. It's like motor vehicle accidents, falls, some things like that. But suicide is the second leading cause of death, and you can imagine what, you know, cancer, health conditions might be are in there too. But it's been that way for a pretty good while now. Typically, you know, and in that 21-22 data, men accounted for a little over 38,000 of those completed acts of suicide, and women accounted for just under 10,000. So a couple of variables in that. Men are more likely to complete acts of suicide, you know, complete an act of suicide, as it says here. Women are less so, but women make far more attempts. In terms of demographics, I mean, it's something that impacts all ages, but certainly it tends to be, you know, men kind of 45 and above tend to be that category for different reasons. A lot of that tends to be access to means and lethal weapons and that sort of thing tends to be a part of that. All right. A couple of things that are important today is that this is not intended to be, you know, a form of counseling or treatment. I mean, you don't have to be a licensed mental health provider to do this. This is really something that anyone can do. And hopefully when we finish today, you'll feel comfortable with that. So I do want to cover some common myths, right? And so here's kind of one of the main takeaways, right, is that someone who's thinking about suicide, number one, I really don't believe they want to do it. Right, I don't really believe that anybody wants to die. I believe they want some other option, right? We're going to talk in a minute about how they're really ambivalent, okay? Really what they're looking for is just someone who's willing to engage with them and talk about it. That's what I really believe. They're just looking, is there someone who can engage with me and talk with me about this really hard to talk about topic, right? So, a couple of things. One myth is, hey, it's only the experts can prevent suicide. You know, the fact is, it's everyone's business. Everyone in this room can prevent the tragedy of suicide. Another one, and this is probably one of the most common ones people worry about, if I ask a person to suicide, all I'm going to do is make them angry and increase the likelihood that they're going to do something. And what we know is that if you ask someone in this caring, face-saving kind of way that I'm going to show you, really what it does is that's what they want. It just lowers their anxiety, opens up communication, and lowers the likelihood that they might end up trying to do something, okay? So there's one of your big takeaways. You're not going to increase the risk. You're not going to put the idea in their head or anything like that. Believe me, they've already thought about it at this point. Another myth is that no one can stop a suicide. It's inevitable. The fact is that if people in crisis can get the help they need, they'll probably never be suicidal again. So let me unpack this one a little bit. So one thing I want to say is that we think of it as a window, right? So typically what happens is an individual has a problem or maybe a series of problems that they can't resolve, right? And that could be a variety of things. You know, for college students, it might be failing classes, losing a scholarship, going to flunk out of school. What might be some things that you all might see in your kind of work, life challenges?
Failed businesses.
Failed business.
Divorce.
Relationships. Yeah.
Lose job.
Okay. So typically what happens is there's a problem or a series of problems that they can't resolve, right? And what happens is they go into this kind of window of time. And that window of time is where it's really dangerous. And that window of time What happens is they can't figure their way out, so the thought of suicide as a solution to their problem comes in as a way out, right? And what we know is that if we can intervene in that window and help them get to the other side, for many people, there's a good chance they're not suicidal again. At the same time, I want to say that there are people, for a variety of different reasons, who will revisit this idea of suicide and maybe chronically suicidal, right? Mental health conditions, chronic depression, you know, in some instances, bipolar disorder, certain health conditions. It could be a variety of things that might be it, but still we can continue to intervene. But that window is really, really critical, right? Because they've lost a sense of hope during that time. I do want to say, too, is that it's not always preventable, right? I just want to be really clear, because I've learned over the years that some people really carry around a sense of guilt that they didn't do something or know something. And I would also just say there are just sometimes that people have made up their mind that this is what they're going to do, and they do it, right? We've had instances in my 25 years at Baylor where, I mean, people were pouring in, you know, in every which way, and they just reached a point, they made up a mind that this is what they're going to do, and they didn't let anybody know, and they took their lives. So I want to say that to balance that out as well. You know, again, that kind of goes to that other myth. You know, the fact is it's the most preventable kind of death. Almost any positive action may save a life. I think what you're going to walk out of here with today is that there are a lot of things that we can do in the way of just showing care and concern and getting a person to help that's going to save a life. But there is this balance with, again, some people make up their mind, right? And anything that we do might not prevent that, okay? And sometimes that's hard to live with, because I know that when someone commits suicide, the survivors, if you will, often wrestle with that. It's like, what did I miss? What could I have done? What could I have said? And that's a pretty common experience. And sometimes the answer is there isn't anything that you could have said or done or anything like that. So another myth, those who talk about it don't do it. In fact, as you're going to see here in a minute, it's actually the people who do talk about it or say something about it are the very ones who will go on to complete an act of suicide. And it goes with this next myth, which is one of the ones I really want to highlight. And the myth is this idea that suicidal people keep their plans to themselves. And really what we know is that most people who are thinking about suicide, they have these different ways in which they communicate their intent. Right, usually a couple of weeks, you know, within their plans to commit suicide. That happens. It happens in other ways, too. The other thing I do at Baylor is I'm the co-chair of the threat assessment team. So even people who are thinking about doing harm to other people, they actually kind of do this as well. They kind of leak these sort of things out. They let their intentions be known. And so with people who are thinking about committing suicide or in this place, they will often in very indirect ways kind of let people know or sense them. And we're going to talk about what some of those signals are. But here's what it means to me. And this is where we're going to talk about hope, but this is where I have some hope, right? And that is, I just don't believe that anyone really wants to die, right? I don't believe that anyone really wants to commit suicide. And I think this idea that they communicate this, you know, shows this ambivalence, right? I mean, and that's this sort of ace in my back pocket is like, I think they're ambivalent. They're looking for some other option. There was a study done, Golden Gate Bridge, California. There's a documentary called The Bridge. I don't recommend it because it sends a message of hopelessness, and we want to send a message of hope. But a number of people over the years have jumped from the Golden Gate Bridge to commit suicide. There was kind of a design flaw on the bridge. It had a very low outer railing. They've since fixed that. But, you know, there were a lot of people who jumped and lived, right? And they pulled all these people together, and they did a research study. And they asked, one of the questions they said was, what was the first thought that went through your mind when you jumped?
And every single person says the same thing. What do you think it was?
I wish I had done that.
Yeah, I don't want to die. Every single person, the first thought to their mind was, I don't want to die. Right? So I hang my hat on that. You know, if I'm sitting there, if I'm meeting with someone, I'm thinking, they don't want to die. Right? But we've got to find some other way to help them. And then this last one, biggest myth, boy, I hear it all the time, right? You know, if I ask about it or talk about it, I'm going to put the idea in their head. That is not true. Trust me, at this point, if they've gone through some of the things I'm going to show you, or they're dealing with depression, they have thought about it plenty, and it's there. You are not going to put the idea in their head at all. Reason I put this up there is because these myths become barriers for us engaging with people, right? So we become fearful. Oh my gosh, I'm concerned about this person. But if I ask about suicide, I'm going to put the idea in their head. So I'm not going to say anything at all. That's just a huge barrier. Really, you do need to say something. I mean, that's what's going to be most helpful. So I'm going to talk in a minute about how you can ask the question. But first, I want to walk through some of the clues and the warning signs. And what I'll say is, you know, we take them all seriously, but obviously the more you see, the more concerned you ought to be. And there's verbal warning signs, there's behaviors, things that people do, and then there's some situational ones, and then I'll talk a little bit about depression. So let's talk about things that people say, right? You know, you might have someone say very directly, I've decided to kill myself, or I'm going to commit suicide. That's not that common. Right, they tend to say it much more indirectly, like, I wish I were dead, I'm going to end it all, if X doesn't happen, I'm going to kill myself. Let's think for a second, what might X be? I know what it is on a college campus, you know. It's usually grades or finances, but relationships. I mean, there's usually something, if X doesn't happen, I'm going to end it all. And we take that you know, pretty seriously. We want to figure out what X is and start to work on that. But more than likely, you're going to hear it like this. I mean, most people don't say it directly, right? It's going to be a little more indirect, more vague. Tired of life, just can't go on. Hey, everybody would be better off without me. Who would care? I just want out. I won't be here much longer, etc. It reminds me of, and I've heard all of these and others from students over the years, but I distinctly remember a student many years ago who was in my office way before Waco was cool. You know, Waco's a cool place now. But, you know, we all remember when Waco wasn't that cool, you know. And she said to me, she said, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be here anymore. And I thought to myself, you know, sort of, I wonder what that's about. And so I pressed a little bit more. And as I asked more, that was her way of saying, I don't want to exist anymore. I mean, she was seriously thinking about suicide. But the way she presented it to me is, well, yeah, I just want to be here anymore. I don't want to be in Waco anymore. I don't want to be a Baylor anymore. But that was her way of introducing that topic. And so sometimes you've got to ask a few more questions about what they mean. And I'm going to show you in a bit exactly how you need to ask that question. But you might hear it this way. And you might hear something, I just can't handle it anymore, it's too much. You might hear that sort of phrase too, and it will cause you to want to dig in a little bit deeper. I'm going to stop there. I've talked a lot. Let me just kind of pause for a second. We've hit myths. I've started with warning signs. Any questions at this point? I probably should have stopped after the myths, but that's okay. Any questions at this point you're thinking about?
When you talk about they have been way more failed attempts.
Right.
Prior to that, is there any data on people who fail attempts to try again?
Yes.
That connection?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that, but I'll go ahead and hit that now. Yes. So here's the data on failed attempts. It all depends on how they respond after they were unsuccessful, right? So an individual who is relieved that they were not successful, likely to never attempt again, right? It's this kind of eye-opening, what in the world was I thinking, right? And I've had plenty of students, right, who have done that, and it's like, oh my gosh, what am, you know, no. And it actually becomes a protective factor from their ever doing again. However, the individual who attempts is unsuccessful and is upset by that, yeah, they're high risk to do it again. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's all about once the attempt was unsuccessful, their reaction. So the person who is upset by that or agitated by that, that they weren't successful, yes, they're very high risk of doing it again. So they need to be high on the radar. Yeah.
You said, you know, 2013, I have two questions. The first question is, have you personally seen in at Baylor the onslaught of this 2013 on in COVID to where it's almost like it's a daily thing, or is it a weekly thing, or is it, how prevalent is it, I guess, in your job?
Yeah, no, in my job, it's just a regular part of the day. Right, and I would say, you know, looking at mental health data in higher ed and university system, it was right around 2010 where everything kind of switched, right? Okay. I mean, the number of students who came in for help dramatically increased, the number of, you know, students reporting suicidal ideation, the severity, everything, there was something kind of around that time. You know, and I could go into a lot of thoughts about that. Some of these shifts, a lot of people point, particularly in youth and college, you know, you've got this, although maybe not directly tied to suicide, but mental health, it's really tied to the thing that we all have sitting on the table, which is our iPhones. There's a correlation, which is different from causation, but there is some strong correlation between access to smartphones, internet, social media use, and rates of mental health. Right, because we have been giving them to our kids at younger and younger ages. And as one author said, it's like you might as well open up the liquor cabinet to your middle school kid, you know, in that kind of way. It's really, but, you know, it's kind of part of our world, you know, and so that's a big part of it, yeah. Right there, big part of
Second
it.
Second question is, when they come in and they say one of these trigger phrases,
yeah.
I think and I'm sure you might address this, but I think my first thing is, oh gosh, I need to talk to them about it. And I get it that I'm going to make it worse would be something that I would come in my brain. But I think it would also be like, I've got to tell all these people, or I've got to, and I know that they don't want to tell all these people because they're kind of almost letting me in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Are you going to talk to us about like, where do you start?
Yeah,
you know?
I will. Yeah, okay. I will. Okay. Probably a place to start is to take a deep breath, right?
Yeah.
But I will start about how to do that and kind of how to walk through that.
Because right? For you, it's just a normal, you've done it so much.
I've done it, yeah. When I was seeing students, I don't see students really anymore, but I was seeing students, it was every single day of my life.
Wow.
It was a regular, you know. So, but I get it for people who are not used to saying things like the word suicide or kill yourself,
yeah.
But the thought of just saying that out loud, hey, have you thought about killing yourself? You know, it's just like, whew, trying to get those words out. Or we can think them in our head, but actually saying them is a lot harder. And so when I talk about some of that, I'll encourage you to actually, you know, practice that, right? Because it's one thing to think it. It's like when you try to say the words, it's like, you know, it's kind of hard to get the words out.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about some ways to do that. I think there's this kind of way to do it. That it's kind of face saving and caring that'll help you, right? That I won't feel so, you know. But you're right, when you're there, the warning signs, you've got this kind of, I need to do this, and so you do want to do it,
yeah.
Right? You know, and at the same time, you're wanting to be present and listen, and because that's a lot of what they need. But I'll walk you through that.
Okay.
I walk you through. Okay, so behavioral clues, right? So, oh, perfect. Cued me up on that one. A previous suicide attempt. Again, it's how they respond, right? It's not necessarily just because they've tried before means they will. It depends on how they reacted to that. Somebody acquiring a gun or stockpiling pills, and then this kind of co-occurring, you know, if they're depressed, that I'll talk about in a little bit. But here's the thing about that. Hopelessness is the thing that we're looking for. It is the most common psychological state of someone who dies from suicide, right? So if I'm meeting with a student, you know, which I've done in the past, and I think we can apply this, and so, you know, maybe they're talking, they've had some thoughts of suicide, it's entered their mind, and they're talking about it, but they're like,
if I get this test tomorrow or I've got this event coming up, they've got this thing that they're looking forward to, right? I kind of take a breath, right? But if they're sitting there and they it's like they can't see tomorrow or they can't see the next, you know, they can't see in the future them doing anything, then I get more worried about them. Does that make sense? So hopelessness is a really big deal. In fact, I would say hope is the antidote to suicide. That's really what we're getting at here. Offering a sense of hope is the counter to suicide. But if a person's in that place of hopelessness, yeah, there's certainly some risk there. You know, I think about acquiring a gun. I mean, you know, we live in Texas, right? So, I mean, everybody's got a gun. They've got 10, you know. I think what you're looking for, there's so much access to guns, but I think what you're looking for might be, if you're looking at all this picture together and then there's this kind of newly acquired purchase or sort of sudden interest in that. I mean, we've had that on campus, people who don't own guns and they go buy one, right? And so it's that, but you know, sometimes you don't always know that, right? But that's something you might look for. A few other things, putting affairs in order, kind of this list here, I've seen all of those. You know, I've had students over the years who, one guy in particular, who was in the process, he had 7 people who were close to him, and he was writing these kind of farewell letters to them. It's his way of saying goodbye, and his plan was when he wrote number 7, he was going to commit suicide, and when I encountered him, he had written 3 or 4 of those, right? We've seen it before where students kind of pack up their rooms and have it all prepared to go. I've seen it where students make an effort to go back and they'll go through that period between that, you know, those 2 weeks prior. They're just sort of, they make it a point to go back and connect with lots of people and visit people. And you know what I'm saying? It's like this mental way of just kind of bringing closure, which leads to them, they're thinking about suicide. So you might see some of that. Giving away prized possessions, this can be really subtle. Some of the ways we've seen it at Baylor, I mean, it's been this subtle. It's been the senior who was supposed to graduate, and for whatever reason, failing a class, not going to graduate, can't start their job, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, stuff that we can work out, but they got into the window, right? And they take their Baylor ring off, and then they set it on the desk. You know, I'm not going to need this. I mean, that's that kind of subtle, but it's a prized possession, you know, kind of thing that they... we've seen that. Here's an interesting one for us, right? The sudden interest or disinterest in religion. That's kind of what we do. We encourage a sudden interest in you know, faith and religion. But it's just, you know, think about it more in the sense of, like, you know, what's going to happen after I die, kind of thing, or a pulling away from faith. I mean, again, there's a lot of things you're looking for. And again, you can see a few of the things there. The anger and the aggression, the irritability, I would think about that more for men because one of the ways men don't do depression very well, right? Men tend to get angry. So, and so women in a general tend to ruminate. Men tend to get angry or use substances. So the anger, irritability tends to be a window into maybe depression, which is kind of more of the risk. Does that make sense? It's more of if I have a young man in my office and they're angry, I'm thinking they're probably depressed, right? So it's just my way of probably introducing that topic. Another one is just this kind of sudden, unexplained sort of seemingly positive behavior change. This thing may seem a little weird, but it's like, all of a sudden, someone becomes very generous with their resources, right? And they're that sort of thing. And it's the sort of thing, this would be hard to pick up, right? But I just put that there. It might cause you want to lean in a little more and dialogue. But, you know, again, I've been talking about this for a long time, but years and years ago, there was a grad, you know, the example that I heard was a grad student at Texas A&M. You know, of course, I got a son there, daughter there, you know, but this is 20 years ago. But basically, didn't have a lot of money. right? And what he did was is he went out for all of his cohort in his graduate program. He bought groceries for everybody, and he bought all this food, and he took it to this store and this store and this store and this store, and it was this, wow, that's really nice of you, right? But when they put it all together, it was this big transition from a guy who really struggled financially to did this really positive thing. But again, it was this kind of sort of a wrapping up, farewell kind of act. So again, hard to pick up. A few other and situational cues, a few of these. Again, unexpected loss of freedom, punishment, loss of financial security, loss of someone close to them, fear of becoming a burden to others. I think in the last number of years, not so much for college students, but I think in the general population, this kind of the impact of whether it's inflation or the economy or COVID, the impact on financial security has certainly been a trigger there for folks. And a few other ones here. Oops, sorry, I jumped ahead one. Let me look here. The one thing I would say about this screen is this one about the death of someone by suicide. The reason why that's so important is it kind of, I like suicide, there's a taboo about it. Does that make sense? There's a certain taboo about it. And I like that taboo in ways, right? I mean, I don't like it in the sense that people won't talk about it, but I like that it's there a little bit. But what happens is when a person close to us commits suicide, it lowers that taboo. It kind of lowers that barrier. And what happens in a person's mind is they think, oh, if so-and-so can do it, I can do it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that's what you're looking for. It's not so much a copycat kind of thing, but it's this kind of, it lowers the inhibition, the barrier. I mean, there was an engineering student at Baylor a few years ago committed suicide. I went to the meeting with everyone, and I typically meet with students. And I had a meeting with a student after that who was, that's exactly what happened for him. He was close to this guy. They were friends, but he was depressed. Think about suicide, and his friend does it. And so what does that do for him? He goes, if he can do it, I can do it. So his risk had gone way up. Now, good outcome. Met with him, kind of got him through that, and he was all right. But that's what you're looking for in that. All right. So three things that you're looking for, and it's really the combination of these three that you're really concerned about, and you want to try to eliminate them. It's kind of a three-legged stool, and if you can kind of get rid of them, one of them is like the stool doesn't stand, but these are the three risk factors. So firearm, because, I mean, it's highly lethal, right? I mean, if there's a firearm involved, if you can get that individual to put that firearm away, give that to someone else to reduce their access, that would be helpful. Alcohol use, just because it lowers inhibitions, people are more likely to just bad judgment. And then this kind of distress. And so, you know, and kind of what you were asking, Sean, a little bit was, you know, when you're trying to reduce risk, obviously there's immediate things you can do. I mean, you know, if there's a firearm, you want to try to remove that or work with people. Do what you can around substances. But this distress thing is really important because typically there's usually things that are really distressing them. And that goes back to that window conversation. There's these kind of problems that people have. They can't resolve them. So suicide becomes the only solution to a perceived unsolvable problem, right? It's just like, I can't get through this, so this comes in. I begin to work on those problems, right? I begin to figure out what are some steps we can take to address this and start to make some headway. And again, when a person's in this situation, what you're really having to deal with is they probably feel hopeless and they probably feel like nothing's going to help. And that's where we have to get more involved, because there probably are things that will help, right? It's just that they feel like it can't. So, you know, again, on a college campus, that's going to be working with financial aid or helping them understand their options, or, you know, for a lot of people, honestly, they got depressed and they can't sleep. They need to sleep. It is amazing. I mean, just, I have seen students who, and young adults who are in the worst shape, and then we have fixed their sleep, and they're just like a different person. And I don't want to try to oversimplify or sort of hype that, but I have certainly seen that. I mean, there's lots of research that shows that poor sleep leads to all kinds of mental health problems, right? I mean, you need to sleep. Your brain has to do this kind of data dump sort of thing. It's got to reset. And so there are things that can happen, you know, and this is where getting to a physician and some things like that can really help. So,
So I think, you know, with the distress problems, it's kind of like, I think when I talk to my wife and she's like, kind of like, I just need you to listen to me, not try to fix me.
Yeah.
Okay. Every once in a while, I try to fix her.
Yeah.
what I hear you saying is, they do need us to not just listen. They need us to actually try to solve some of the distress that they are having with actual getting them sleep or helping them with their grades or something, actually trying to be a fixer. So it seems like you have that ability with, you know, you can pull strings, but for the normal person who can't pull strings necessarily, I sometimes wonder how much I would just lean back and be a listener and how much can I change their world.
Yeah, and so it's a good question because I think I should say that if you're in this situation, I would say, you know, the QPR, the last one, is refer. So if you're in this situation, really you want to get them connected to a professional. And I think there's some roles you can play, but I think if you're here, yeah, you really want to get them to a professional. Because, yeah, there's a big listening part, and the listening part actually kind of helps people get to this kind of swell of a crisis and start to calm down. But then you need to have these kind of, there's a whole thing on the clinical side about how you kind of work with someone who's suicidal. There's a lot of things. I wouldn't expect anyone here to do that. You know, the outcome I'd hope for from here is that you're going to recognize the myths, you're going to recognize the warning signs, and you're going to be willing to and know how to engage and ultimately get them to someone who could do the rest of that. Maybe I should have said that up front. I wouldn't expect you to do that.
But in your situation, you are trying to solve some of the major problems by entering in.
That's the game plan, and we're gonna work hard and fast on that. And you know, and typically on something like this, I might see them every day for a while.
Yeah,
it's not a come back next week or come back in 2 weeks. I'm gonna see you tomorrow, and I'm gonna see you the next day.
Yeah,
and you know, and we're gonna check in, and in my mind, so the whole thing is what I'm focused on is compliance with treatment. Right, so as long as they're compliant, I feel good about that. But when they're not compliant, it's when they kind of elevate their risk, and I might do some other thing, call the police or something like that. So that's kind of a whole clinical thing, you know, things like you might hear about people doing safety contracts or filling out forms where I promise not to kill myself. You know, that no one should be doing that because that's not going to stand up in court because, you know, they're like, you know, hey, you know, Dr. Carpenter, you obviously thought they were so serious that you had them sign this form. Sounds like you should have done something more. So it's really about what you're looking for. As long as you're looking for compliance, and compliance is the key. But when they're not compliant, so we do other stuff. But that was a little clinical side. You know, but yeah.
I have a question, but it may not be in this section.
So okay, yeah.
It relates to offering hope.
Okay.
So my question is, in a situation where those cues are things like terminal illness and someone in pain, I mean, I know Jesus and I know, you know, here we want to do, but if somebody really, they're hurting and it's not a, how, what do you do? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like something.
Well, hold that and we'll come to it in a little bit. Yeah.
Just a thought I had had and wrote down.
Yeah, about how
you offer hope,
a sense of hope. And it might be different for different things. And some of those are going to be hard. Right. Some are going to be really tough, right? I have a lot of thoughts on just the value of being with people and listening to people is probably way more than we can all do that. It's probably way more powerful than we realize. You know, I think Carl's doing a good job highlighting that the other week.
If we do that, come alongside these people, I mean, all we're talking to them, does that at least help alleviate that idea that nobody cares about me, nobody's going to know I'm gone.
I mean, we should never underestimate the value of what it means to have another person that we can talk about these things with. It's amazing. It's just amazing. The problem is that we're just not willing to do it. And particularly on this, because it's kind of hard, we get afraid and scared, and it's messy. But I'm telling you, I mean, the value of just listening and supporting people and being there is amazing, right? We were designed for it. Doesn't solve everything. I think you need, you know, but it's there's a role you can play. So I'll get to that here in a second. I want to get to a few other things here. I do want to talk about depression. Untreated depression is the number one cause of suicide. At least 25%, I think it's probably higher by now, of all Americans experience an episode of clinical depression in their lifetime. So it's not that uncommon. I mean, it's probably, you know, I think for college students, this is the number two reason they come in. Number one is anxiety. But there's just a lot of things that we can do, right? Now, if you take everything in kind of the mental health landscape, we're better at some stuff than others, right? But one thing we're pretty good at, we've had good success with, is people who are depressed. I think the medications are just so much better. You know, they're much more pinpointed. They don't have as many side effects. They've really improved. I think, you know, if people can really engage in treatment, like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, other types of therapy, it really works. What I have found with medication, and it varies, some people might be on medication, it might be something they do for their lifetime, but, you know, I've seen a lot of college students who might take it for a season, right? It might not be something permanent, but it kind of helps, you know, they need some energy, they need to be able to focus. So I mean, sometimes the medicine just helps them engage in therapy, right? I mean, if you're feeling that bad, you're having a hard time doing much of anything, right? And so there's just a lot of things that are there that can be really, really helpful. So we'll do this real quick. Let's just brainstorm as a group. So what are the symptoms of depression? If nothing else, you've seen the commercials, right? You have experience in your own life. But what are they?
Irritable.
Yeah.
Sleeping.
Yeah. Either.
Overeating. Not eating.
Yeah. Or not eating. Loss of appetite. Could be that.
Socially withdrawn.
Yes. Pullback, withdrawn. Yeah. All right, so you guys got that and some others. So you can see this common list here. Sleep's a big one. Can't concentrate. Just don't enjoy things. Anhedonia, just stuff they normally used to do. Isolated, no energy, no motivation, thoughts of death, suicide or self-harm. One thing I will say is, this is a little bit technical, but some of the distinctions between some people have what's called morbid ruminations, right? So I'm just kind of sharing you that a little bit. A lot of times when people are depressed, they think about death. That's really common, right? And we call it morbid ruminations. They imagine themselves, they've died, they imagine the funeral, imagine who would come or who would not come. I mean, you know, they kind of play, you know, depressed. Still important, pay attention to it, but it is different from thinking about suicide, like thinking about what I'm going to do, how I'm going to do it, kind of planning for that. But morbid ruminations, very common. In fact, I'm willing to bet most everybody here has had it at one point or another, right? It's just like, it's just life, right? So that's not, I mean, that's really common to, and just in our humanness to kind of go through those sort of things. I'll ask a quick question as I think about this. So we think about this on a college campus. How do you think that might play out in church? And I'm particularly looking at this kind of religious, kind of Christian environment. So somebody's depressed. What the hell? How might that play out in terms of, like, what might that be like for them if they are depressed? What might they do? What might they not do? What might barriers might be created? I just want to. I know it, I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I wonder. What do y'all think?
I think they feel like they shouldn't be that way, and so they feel like they're not a good Christian because yeah. they're depressed.
Yeah, that's it.
Shame spiral.
Shame, yeah. Come to church every morning and there's a lot of energy. Everybody's pumped up and they're not there yeah. if they're coming at all. So, and what do you think that it creates? A sense of shame.
God didn't love them.
God didn't love me. I'm not a Christian. So that's just something I think in our particular context we have to pay attention to. And it can become this sort of like, I've got to do more, right? So I really appreciate these sermons about just being loved for who you are and kind of trying to get through that. But I think there are certain things we have to really pay attention to here, because I think a person who's depressed or struggling might have a hard time, frankly. Just they might have a hard time telling somebody because of what it might mean for them. I just wanted to mention that. All right, a few other things. Let me see what time we're at. Okay, we're getting close to the end. Again, you're in a position to notice these sorts of things. So I want to talk about this QPR part and asking the question. Here's the main thing. I need to follow up with you, maybe get you guys some resources. I just realized that. I may have to follow up and do that with these folks. So I'm going to talk about these three steps, right, about how to engage someone. Again, what I would say is, you know, if you're feeling nervous, you're not used to doing this, I get it. It's okay. Just ask it, right? And if you can't, go get somebody else, right? But how do you ask the question? So you're there, you're meeting with somebody in life group or a section, and you're aware that they've had some pretty hard things happen, right? Maybe they've had a failed business or lost a job. They've got some financial challenges or whatever it might be. And you see some of these things about where they feel depressed. And, you know, and so you've been listening to them, you know, just being present with them, and you're thinking, yeah, I did this. I went to this training with Jim, right? I need to do something here. Sean, like you said earlier, you got that feeling. And you need to ask a question, right, at this point. There's two ways you can ask it. You can ask it in this less direct way or a direct way I'm going to show you. I am not a fan of the less direct way. I'll just tell you that right now. Now, if it helps you to kind of warm up to be direct, that's okay. But what do you think if you just said, you ever just want to get away from everything? If you ask that, what? Yeah, all the time. Yeah, this morning when I woke up. Right? Yeah. I mean, does that really tell you what you need to know? No, it doesn't tell you what you need to know.
You're talking about vacation?
Yeah. Do you ever wish you'd go to sleep and never wake up? Maybe it gets a little closer, but you know what I'm saying? It's not really getting at the question. And I will tell you this. A person who is having these thoughts, they are looking to see if they want to have this conversation, but believe me, they're reading you. They're trying to see, can you have this? Can you do this? Right? They've got a feeler. You know, I mean, they can read this kind of thing. So if you do this, and is this where you stop? You're just not going to know, right? So, this is where, you know, you've just got to be direct. And research says you got to use one of two phrases. You got to use the phrase commit suicide or kill yourself. And that's the part where I've said that 100 million times, but most people have not. But it's got to be in one of those two ways, okay? And so, you know, you seem really depressed. I wonder if you think about suicide, you ever think about killing yourself. And so what I might do is something like this. After I've listened to them for a while, I say, hey, look, I really care about you. You're going through a hard time. I know that sometimes when people go through these things, and certainly you feel depressed like it sounds you are, they have, at times, they think about killing themselves. Have you been thinking about killing yourself? It's caring. It's face-saving, because, hey, this is what people go through. But it is direct, because you're using one of those two phrases. And that's how you get an answer, right? That's how you do it right there. Again, you know, as I've said, why are you concerned? That red flag's going up. And then Yeah, you summarize what you've heard and then ask it in a space-saving kind of way. All right, I'm going to stop right there. I'm going to tell you how to not ask it. But any thought, any questions on how to ask? And then I'll tell you what to do after you get an answer. But this is, does that make sense? Right? You want to, if you need to be less direct, fine. But you've got to be direct. Right? You've just got to do it. Yeah, Sean.
I'm sorry to keep asking.
No, you're good. Good question.
When you have done that with people,
yeah.
And I'm sure you're going to get to that when they're saying yes. When you have done that, does it ever offend those who are like, no, don't say that? Or, you know, do they get mad when they're not?
That's one of those myths that people are going to get mad or something like that. I've never had that happen. People worry about that a lot. But in my mind, I've also made a decision, right, that I'm willing to let them get mad at me. And I think that's what the thing that we all have to decide, that, okay, I'm willing for somebody to get mad at me if I ask this question because I think it's that important. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never had it happen, but I'm also willing to let them be angry with me. I mean, hey, I care about you enough to ask this. Believe me, it's not easy for me to ask this, you know, internally, so I care that much. But, you know, if you get mad, then I can't control it. So there are some ways not to ask the question. Right? Hey, you're not suicidal, are you? You're not thinking about killing yourself or anything like that. You know, I mean, you wouldn't do anything stupid or crazy, would you? Why do you think? What's wrong with this?
No.
More shame.
Yeah. More shame, right? And I got to tell you this, to somebody who's thinking about suicide, it is not a stupid idea. It's not a crazy idea at all. I mean, to them, I mean, this is my answer. This is my solution to end all of this pain and misery that I'm in. So it's not a stupid idea. It's not a crazy idea. To them, in many ways, it makes sense, right? Yeah.
I've dealt this multiple times here at the church. We've done funerals. People have committed suicide. And family members, I'm going over the thing in my mind that happened years ago. The family members felt like the person did, like this was their only option. And then they want to promote that to the people who come. Like, we got school teachers and students come, and I'm like, and so I'm in this tension, and maybe I'm responsibility is my number one, so maybe I get over-responsible. And I'm thinking, I can't let you get out and tell everybody, you're going to tell school kids. This, you know, so I kind of, a couple times I've intervened, and then I kind of was like, I made people mad.
Because
stopping them from saying this was their only option. Like the family member wanted to make the, they wanted the person who took their life to be honored.
Yeah.
So they said, don't think she had to do that.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, you did the right thing. So I struggled with that back and forth. The family was kind of, and they could have done it. I just kind of said, I don't think you should say that.
Yeah. So one of the things that whenever I've been through training, and, you know, Baylor had, you know, there was a professor, he's probably was one of the leading national experts in suicidology. And he said, hey, everybody, every clinician's got to make up, has got to answer a question in their mind, and that's the question, right? And it's, do you ever think it's okay? And my answer was no. And his answer was no, right? Because there's always so much that can be done, and the legacy that gets left is devastating. It is just the wake that it creates behind and the legacy to the people that are there, and family and friends and stuff. It's to me, I would say, I'm like you, I would say that's never the option. There's plenty of other options. So, but good for you. But that's, I've just never seen that. That's all right. So wrapping up here, you know, again. Some of the ways not to do that. Again, find someone who can ask the question. And then you've asked the question, you get an answer. And so the QPR, the P stands for persuade. And that's just simply persuade someone to live. This is one of these other key points I want you to walk out of here with. Remember, right, suicide is not the problem. I know this is kind of a hard thing to kind of get, but suicide's not the problem. It's just the only solution they can think of to a perceived unsolvable problem.
they see this problem or a series of problems and they think of, that I can't resolve them, so suicide comes in as the only thing I can think of to resolve it. Okay? And that's really important to remember. So, you know, it's just simple things, right? Just what would you want to say? Hey, I care about you. You matter. I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to help you get through this. I'm on your side. I'm worried about you. It's just that's that offering of hope is really what that is. And then ask, hey, will you go with me to get help? Will you let me get you some help? Will you promise me you won't do anything, kill yourself until I've gotten you some help? That's all the persuade is. It's just, I mean, just lean in. I care about you, you know, in a very personal kind of way. And I would say your willingness to listen and to help is what rekindles hope. This is kind of what we've been talking about. Your willingness to listen, to engage, and help them rekindles hope, because that's what they're looking. You know what I'm saying? I go back to that ambivalence. This really isn't what they want to do, but they're going to need somebody to help them walk through it. And then what you really want to do is you want to refer them, right? This is where, at this point, you know, there's things you can do, but this is where you want to refer them to somebody who can help. So the best referral is taking them directly. We'll talk about maybe what this looks like at church, but the best referral is trying to get them directly to someone who can help, whether that's a clinician, a counselor, maybe there's somebody, you're all structured here, maybe that's kind of somebody higher up the chain. But that's the best referral, and you may have to be pretty active with that and walking them through that. The next best would be, hey, just getting a commitment, hey, from them to stay safe until you can get them some help and make some arrangements and follow up with that. And then the third one, because I've had this happen where, you know, it's a friend who lives in Florida. You know, it's like you can't do one or two, but you're just trying to help them. And so it might be, hey, let me try to give you some resources. Here's the deal. Any willingness on their part to listen and accept help is a really good sign, right? So anything you can do in that way. A few thoughts. Again, many people are depressed, have morbid ruminations, they have suicidal thoughts. Again, this is where I don't like to put people in kind of this sort of make these decisions. But, you know, if there's no kind of plan or no kind of intent, you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to distinguish between what's immediate and what's not. Somebody who's got a plan or they share with you a plan or their intent, we take that there's a time frame that is more serious. Maybe somebody that hasn't really thought about specifics, we've got a little bit more grace there time-wise to help them. But if you've got anybody that's got any kind of plan, a method, a means, a time frame, I mean, it's very immediate at that point, right? There's a whole clinical thing that we kind of go through. I call it a push-pull, right? And the way I do it is I say on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 being I have no intent to commit suicide, 10 being yes, I'm going to kill myself today. Where are you? Well, I'm a 5. Okay. So what would have to happen that would push you to a 10? Get it? That's the push. I'm kind of looking for what those factors are that might push it. Well, if I fail chemistry or whatever, and then I plan around that. And then what are protective factors? Well, you know, my family, I've got a younger sister, you know, I'm kind of looking for that, you know, and obviously people who don't have a lot of protective factors, or don't have a lot of friends, or don't have a lot of reason for living or a future thought of a job, I get more worried about them too. Like, I love, you know, more protective factors the better, but that's on the clinical kind of side of things. Let's see. I did want to say a little bit, and maybe this is where we have a little bit of dialogue here, but it's kind of this, where do you refer someone who's needing further evaluation for their or others' safety? I mean, I imagine, I don't know, is there kind of a chain here where life group leaders are supposed to let people know or something like that?
Section leaders, I'm a pastor. Yep. I've had a lot of those come to me.
Okay. Yeah. So we're talking about situations. These would be some situations where a person has a plan or intent, and it's obviously more serious. We've had some changes in Waco. The DePaul Center, which was our main inpatient psychiatric facility, has closed. It closed last December. It is a pretty big hole that's left in the community. Most of where we go is to the MHMR Crisis Center. They have expanded, and that's been a really good resource. You know, we send students there. They can go there and be evaluated. You know, you may have access, you know, with this more adult population, you may have access to a clinician or a physician or a provider, try to get them in. But these kind of really urgent situations, Providence ER, and MHMR has a crisis line and a mobile crisis outreach team that's available as well. I just know, in my world at Baylor, if they're in our office and we think they're imminently suicidal, we do what we, because we're clinicians, we can do what's called an EDO or emergency detention order, and we have them go to MHMR Crisis Center where they're evaluated by a psychiatrist who then makes the call, and they go from there whether they, you know, they go to a different hospital. There's three inpatient facilities in our area. There's Oceans Behavioral Health here in town. There's Canyon Creek in Temple, and another CC in Belton. No, he's going to be Canyon Creek, Cedar Crest. Yeah, that's what it is. So we've got those three. But anyway, that's the really, if it's really serious, this is where you would go.
Jim?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't call you wouldn't call Oceans directly?
Not in my world. You know, I think you could take them to Oceans. You could call MCOT. You know, you could go to an ER. You know, after hours, you could do that. Those are some of the options that you have. But you could go with them to the MHMR Crisis Center, but sometimes they might be there for a while. But that's just been part of it. Yeah.
So. If it's not imminent crisis, but we're really wanting them to get that counseling, you know, something that gives them resource, struggle is the side of COVID. It's 6 months before you can get an appointment.
Yeah, it's a real, it's pretty backed up.
And if we don't have insurance,
right,
then we're really further out because it's STARI or Family Counseling, Children's Services, or something.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. I know some of the low cost or sliding scale fees. Are they 6 months too? Yeah, they're out too. Yeah, I think that's where I got to think about that one for a second. Right, that's a tough one. Yeah, it's really changed.
I mean, then it comes again into like Sean and I have been just kind of, it seems like we're coming back to it's the care and stuff. But
let me think about that one a little bit more. But it's like I got to put a different hat on to think about that. So, yeah.
Dr. Marshall, what is it?
I was going to say, somebody asked me, just recently, I found out it's called Heart of Texas Behavioral Health Care Network. They've got a lot of resources that I end up sending someone to. So they've got some crisis facilities and some counselors for people who don't have insurance. So that's another resource that I recently came in contact with.
Thank you so much for doing this training for us. One of the things that I've run into in the realm of suicide or suicidal talk are people that seem like their relational bucket that deposits in just go right through. And depression and suicide seems to be for them, in the church setting, a way to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't know how to get healthy relationships elsewhere, and then they're serious, but it's almost like a threat that I'm trying to get you to be my everything,
right,
or this life group to be my everything, or everyone to kind of pay attention. And it's like, this is so helpful at one level, and then for those broader issues where it's like you just realize there's a whole lot of work that would need to happen for them to stabilize.
Yeah.
How do y'all, what's your advice on something like that?
Yeah, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Right, it's so a couple of thoughts on that are, one, I think as individuals in this room have to understand where your boundaries and limits are, right? I mean, there is so much you can do and be available and in the role you can be, but you're not an on-call 24/7 person to meet all those needs. And I think in those sort of cases, really that's where they need professional, they really need a professional help, professional assistance, to somebody who can walk with them, who can be available to them, who's got all the crisis backup in place. And so where that becomes difficult, and this is the boundary part, is sometimes they won't do that, right? And it's like, hey, we have this plan, we've got this person's available to you, but they're not meeting with them. And that becomes a bit of a boundary kind of thing. It's like, hey, this is what I'm willing to do and I'm able to do, but I can't do these things, but we have this, we've made this available for you to do. What's keeping you from taking that step? It gets really complicated at times to navigate, because you're right, there's more going on than that are just depressed. There's probably a whole lot of other stuff that's that needs to be unpacked there. But I have had plenty of situations where, you know, here at church or other churches, and particularly religious settings, because we're all kind and caring and want to be helpful, but they can really pull a lot of time and attention resources. So to me, it's more about, hey, I'm going to be here, but this is what I can. And I think it's okay. I think it's okay to have a boundary about what I'm willing to do, and we really need you to do this other thing. I'm not capable of helping you the way you need to be helped, and that's, I'm not. It's a short answer to a really hard situation. Believe me, a really hard situation, because I've seen it a bunch. So,
thank you so much.
I'm gonna kind of, and I think I got this number right. In church, so you
don't
know that.
I wouldn't call it counseling office, but.
Oh, okay. I'll delete that smart slide.
Yeah.
Y'all used to, right? Y'all used to, didn't you?
Yeah, we had an LPC on staff. We don't anymore.
Okay, that's right.
So I refer people to LPCs.
Okay.
So
I'll edit my slides.
When you text me, I meant to reply. Okay. I thought I'd tell you that.
Okay. Only other quick thing is, if someone's in immediate danger, like they've already injured themselves, they've taken an overdose, they have a weapon threatening to use it, top of a bridge, stairway, etc., just call 911, right? You know. So, and call 911 to deal with that. And here's a few other things, and I'll try to get these resources to Vincent. And this is just the whole safety net. I think that role that you guys can play is, you know, you can be a friend, you know, how do you set up a support, right? How do you do pastoral care, be a friend, life group, section? I mean, you want to have lots of people who are engaged in helping them with this. Of course, there's university resources if it's a student that are available to them. But this isn't something that one person does alone. At this point, they need to have someone, they need to be referred to someone who can help them professionally. But then I think the church's role is to be this kind of support and offer care if they walk through that. All right. Again, I just want to say, as you apply this, you plant seeds of hope. And that's what, hope is what prevents suicide, right? So I'll stop there. And I don't think I have anything else. All right.
So we got a little bit of time. Any questions?
Yeah,
we have some questions.
All right.
Let's say you are down front praying for someone, and someone presents that you think it's imminent that they're going to commit suicide. What do you do? Are there legal boundaries? I mean, of course, they're caring, pastoral desires, but what should I do?
I'm running the gamut. I'm running the traps in my head,
okay,
right?
So
I'm there,
yep.
But I'm not a psychologist, right? I'm there, and someone shares with me these thoughts of, like, I'm gonna kill myself, and they come to you for prayer. My first thing would be, this is going to take a little longer, and I don't know what the setup is, but I might try to find a way where I can maybe slide off to the side or get to a room with me and bring in another person,
right,
to spend more time with them. Right? That's probably what I'm going to do, because it's too short of a conversation. That's probably what I'm going to do is do that. Now, let's think of something else. Let's say they say that, and you try to do that, and they take off. They run. I'm probably going to call the police at that point. Probably what I do. I call the police and say, here's the information I have. They just shared they were going to do this, and this is what they were going to do, and here's the best information I got. I'm trying to find them.
What if they don't run? Do you still call the police?
Not necessarily, no.
How do you know when to?
Well, I think it's if in meeting with them, right, and I'm kind of bringing in my resources and I felt like they were not safe. It's like I have a plan. I'm imminent. You know, I'm going to do this. I've got a gun. And then what I'm going to work with them on is, hey, I think you need some help more than what we can do. What would you be willing to do the following? And so, you know, again, most people, they could be at that place where they're a 10, and then those places where they're a 10, let's kind of walk through maybe having you go to the crisis center, go to the hospital. You know, I might be willing to drive with someone to take them. I would probably, that wouldn't be my first option. I probably would probably call the MCOT, Mobile Crisis Outreach Team, and see if they could come on site, do an eval. You know, in fact, I'm not driving, I take that back. You know, I was thinking out loud, I'm not driving. I'd probably call MCOT. You know, if I couldn't get them to go, I'd probably call MCOT and work that way. Yeah, I don't know if I'm in the audience. Text me, you know, and I might advise you. I'm not coming down. I get into a kind of different kind of role because of my license. So, but I might be able to advise a little bit. You know, I might be able to give you some thoughts. But
what service do you go to?
Yeah, I mix it up. Never know when I'm there.
Thanks, Jim.
Does that happen? Do y'all have people do that?
Yes.
Wow.
I've had a person leave when we went there, and they refused.
Yeah, I probably would. Like, I'm required to do something, but I would say.
I don't think we are.
It's
probably got me up. I thought we were.
I think we are.
I think I think it's. I would do it. I would contact police. You know, on that, I would definitely do it, and just let them know, and then they can kind of do the best they can. But you've done your part.
You can't make those people stay though.
No, no, and we've had students who've ran from our office and things like that. But, okay. Yeah, I didn't realize that was...
It's common. Pretty common from a poll I took, of at least people, when I used to head that up, all the industry.
Or they might not be at a 10, but
right.
if they mention in the prayer, I didn't have any...
Yeah, it's a run of the game. That's right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if it were me, I might want to figure out a way to spend a little more time with them to get a sense of where they were and come up with ways to support them.
Yeah.
That's just my thought. But I don't know what all you have set up or what the capacity is for that. I shouldn't be surprised that that happens more now that I think about it. I've just never had, you know, when Amy and I used to do front for prayer, we just never had it happen. I could see where it was. I mean, people are really struggling with, and part of that is, you know, like I talked about before, as I'm thinking it through, I mean, they're letting you know. Right? I mean, it's that whole part. It's that ambivalence. I mean, people who are thinking about it are letting people know. So I would really take it seriously because this may be the only time, hey, I'm here, I'm in a desperate moment, I've come to church.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to let this stranger
know. Our people are good about wrapping around them.
Yeah.
Come up, our people, they're good about getting around them and calling and being with them all, especially the younger people. So that's what typically has been.
Yeah, the more I think about it, I would take that pretty seriously as I'm starting to kind of think through things. I would take that pretty seriously, for sure.
Yeah. Is there a different approach if it's a youth or if it's an adult when you're trying to talk to them in regards to
I think with youth, I would imagine you probably want to bring parents in to that. There are some kind of from a legal standpoint, you know, if you're a clinician and you're working with a minor, there are certain conditions or situations where you can engage with a minor without parental approval. Suicide's one, drug or alcohol use is another, you know, in that moment. But typically in any other thing, you know, provider, doctor, whatever, they've got to get parental, you know, release. So my first thought would be getting a parent involved, you know, on that at some point. Maybe
maybe listening to the student and say, hey, we really need to get your parents involved. And, but I would say if a student, a youth told me, I don't want my parents knowing, but they've unloaded all this on me, there's no way I'm not telling my parents.
Yeah.
I mean, mom, dad are going to know. I found this out, too, with college students. Most college students, they don't accurately read how their family will respond. They always think that the family's going to come down hard and be disappointed. I just never seen that. Most parents are really worried and really care and are glad they know. But, I would be working towards getting parents included for sure, a family. I would not want to take that on with a minor.
Would you say that the probably mainstream thought is that males are more likely to use firearms and women are more likely to use pills? And yeah. So that would be the, because if I'm engaging with women and I'm not thinking usually to look for firearms. Or, you know,
yeah, I mean, like men are, I was just talking about the numbers, men are more likely to complete. They tend to use more lethal means. They've got access. They know how to use guns. Women tend to attempt more. I would not necessarily rule out if I was talking to someone who's a woman and their access to guns. You know, we've had a number of students, women who used a gun. Yeah. It's kind of grown a little bit. So again, there's just such access to firearms, you know, more than stuff. But there is a difference. There does tend to be a difference between men and women. So for sure.
Method.
Yeah. So, Stan.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but in all your experience, do you see like a spiritual aspect to suicide? I mean, I'm coming from that. I've worked with a guy years ago who wrote one of those little self-published booklets about, he really believed that suicide was a spirit.
Okay.
You know, like depression or like, but it's from the spiritual realm. And do you, and we know the thief came to kill, steal, and destroy.
Yeah. I think, well, I could talk for a long time about this one. So I think there's both, right? So I think any kind of death, destruction, anything we're talking about, there is a spiritual piece to that, whether that's something directly demonic or it's a byproduct of our fallen world, right? We have a fallen world. It's also part of it, right? Our health and health conditions that can relate to this. I mean, ultimately, the source of that, you know, is this kind of fallen nature. I do believe that there are people where there is a direct spiritual connection to that, right? Where it might be something more spiritual or more demonic. I just think that in my world and what I do, I'm probably going to hand that part off to you guys at the church, and I'm going to kind of come at it from what I have. So it's both and.
Okay.
I kind of hold that, and I don't know. I live in a very complicated world. Amy can tell you. I live in a very complicated world. I hold a lot of tensions because I've seen it both, and then I kind of work at it with both when I can. But I've also seen situations where people, I think if you default so much on the spiritual that you're not recognizing what's in front of you, there's a health condition. I mean, our brain is physical, right? We know well dopamine, serotonin. We know that those levels can be off. And one of my favorite articles of all time was a really old Charisma magazine, right? I love this one, right? I got to find it somewhere. It's old. And on the front of that Charisma magazine, it says, Prozac or the Holy Spirit, right? It was great. And here's the deal. Here's what I liked about it. It told the story of a woman who was depressed. She was really depressed. She was so depressed, she couldn't take care of her kids. You know, she was certainly not anything to her to be able to work, care for anybody,
responsibilities in the house, couldn't engage in worship, anything, right? But she primarily came from this world that said it's all spiritual, right? Not to say that it wasn't. I think it kind of goes hand in hand. But she started taking Prozac. And she tells the story of how she was able to go to church, she was able to worship, she was able to care for her kids. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So I would caution against kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of bifurcating those two things or making them mutually exclusive. It's a complexity that goes together. So I would say probably in her world, I mean, the medicine really helped her. And then there were probably some things on a spiritual side that would probably be really helpful as well to help her. I mean, I think when we have weaknesses or pain in our life, I really do think it's like blood in the water, the devil, right? I mean, he sees that and he's going to come after those places of weakness and vulnerability. So a person who might be susceptible to depression or be experiencing depression, I think it's also something that, the enemy is going to go after at the same time. So I could talk for a long time about that. But hopefully I've given you feel for both of that. Okay. Matt Stanford, who used to be here at Antioch for a long time, he runs a center now. He wrote a book about the role of mental health in the church. I think he balances that out really well. What's that called? Grace for the Afflicted. Yeah. It's a really good book. Yeah. So it's, I think, kind of holding those two pieces together is really important. I'll give you another example. So I do this threat assessment thing at the university, and I was just at a conference, and I think this relates, and you'll understand that one of the examples they gave of kind of in this conference was at a college campus, right? And the deal was there was this guy in a fraternity, and he was really struggling with thoughts of suicide and his kind of thoughts of hurting other people and stuff. So he reached out to all his fraternity brothers, right? And he had sent in, and they showed the text on the screen, and they must have been all believers or something, or all these guys are Christians. He sends in all this stuff he's struggling with. Again, what's he doing? He's trying to reach out. He's trying to let somebody know. I need somebody to talk to. He's trying, right? And again, trying to pick it up. But it shows what they sent back to him. Now, don't get me wrong, right? I think this is good, but what were they sending back to him? They were sending back Bible verses, right? So they're sending verses, which Word of God's powerful, sharper than a two-edged sword. But I'm sitting in my chair going, man, did anybody, call him on the phone? Go over to his house?
Oh, wow.
You know what I'm saying? And just like, does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's like, I think those things are powerful, but I think God has also created us relationally. And we have a deep need to be in relation with other people. I mean, connection is this incredible buffer actually connection with other people is a huge buffer to all of these mental health things we're talking about. I mean, it's unbelievable buffer against anxiety, depression, everything when we feel connected. So hopefully that makes it, it's not that those things are wrong, but there's other things that we can do that kind of come together. I know that we're on time.
One more question.
Okay, all right.
Are there any Christian resources that you can direct us to where we can inform ourselves a little bit better as parents and maybe even as pastors? I don't know, a website or...
Yeah, I would say Matt's books, The Grace for the Afflicted, and the other book that he wrote would be probably where I would start. There is a network called AACC, American Association of Christian Counselors. And so it's a really large network, and they have resources and conferences. A lot of times they'll do a conference in Dallas. And the people that go there aren't all licensed mental health providers. There are lots and lots of pastors and lay pastors who are there as a part of that. And so that would be the two things that come to my mind. And all of those authors, the people who go there, do really good work and publish really good resources. But I'd say Matt's book is probably a great place to...
What's the name of it again?
Grace for the Afflicted.
Okay.
The other one is AACC, American Association of Christian Counselors. They'll do some online stuff, but I think they'll have conferences up in Dallas and I went for years to those things. They're really good.
Well, I personally appreciate what you said today. I mean, the danger triangle or whatever you were talking about. A lifelong friend, Yeah. You know, those three things were there. And,
What you're trying to do is if I can eliminate at least one of those, I give myself a good chance.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm going for.
Y'all thank Matt.
Thank you.
All right. You put this book on my mind. I'd love to pray for you, Jim.
Okay, please.
So let's reach a hand out to a Jim giving out to us. Lord, we thank you for our brother, our friend, Jim and Amy. Thank you for their love for you and our church. Thank you for the ways that Jim gives out in so many directions, students and leadership and the university setting and the church, God. And Lord, where word says when someone refreshes others, let them be refreshed. Lord, so as he gives of himself, he gives out, we pray you refresh him, cover him, his mind, his heart, his emotions, Lord. We pray peace to his soul today. Restore his soul as he's given and equipped us well today. So we bless him. We thank him. We strengthen him today. We bless the whole Marsh family. This is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen. All right.
Amen.
Thanks.
Amen.
Oh, yeah. Okay.